then, I got hooked by a dead teenager,
Yuki said.
He was wrongly arrested and killed while awaiting trial. His family is devastated, rightfully so. The Defense League...
Parisi already knew where she was going with this. She felt thunderheads gathering.
You're going to sue the city? The SFPD? You're coming after us?
It's the right thing to do.
I hear you, Parisi said. But I don't understand you.
There was a look of outrage on her friend's face that Yuki had seen before, just not directed at her. Parisi's chair spun noisily as he got out of it. He crossed the room and opened his door wide. He said to her,
Human resources will bring you some empty boxes and walk you out. You'll surrender your card, your laptop, and your keys immediately. I'll have payroll cut your check.
Len, I'm indebted to you. I know how much...
Save it, he said. I'll see you in court. And I do mean me. Personally.
He returned to his desk chair and picked up the phone. He punched in some numbers, then swiveled around so that his back was to her. He said,
Michelle, it's Parisi.
Michelle Forrest was head of human resources. Yuki left Len's office and, dazed, walked to her own. She hadn't intended to tear up her life. She wanted a different job. And now her husband was pissed at her. Len was threatening to destroy her in court, and she hadn't even told Zach Jordan that she was accepting the position. Well, she was taking the job, and she was going to win compensation for the Cordell family for the wrongful death of Aaron Ray. There was no turning back now. Chapter 16. I was obsessing about Tina Strickler as I drove to work that morning. Yesterday, Strickler had been ripped up her midsection with a long, sharp blade, a vicious murder that felt personal. I couldn't shake the feeling that there was a connection between her and the other women who had each been killed with knives on May 12th, now 3 years in a row. Brady has a keen investigative mind, and I really wanted his thoughts on this. I walked through the gate to the squad room and saw that Brady was in his small, glass-walled cubicle at the back of the bullpen. He was behind his desk, his blue shirt stretched across his chest and his bulging biceps. His white blonde hair was pulled back into a short pony, revealing where a part of his left ear had been shot off during a fierce gunfight in which he had acted heroically and saved a lot of lives. Right now, however, he was fixated on his laptop. I said hey to Brenda, waved at a few of the day shift guys who looked up as I strode past, then rapped my knuckles on Brady's door. He waved me in and I took a seat across from him. I said, about that homicide yesterday on Balmy Alley.
Yep. Michaels and Wang are working it.
I know. What I'm thinking is that there's something familiar about this killing.
Tell Michaels. Jacoby's calling me 3 times a day about the Windbreaker cop robberies. I'm worried about Jacoby. I know he doesn't want to retire with the stink of these douchebags all over him. Or all over us. And now the press has sniffed it out. I've got questions from I don't know how many papers and TV reporters and, of course, a ton of email from the concerned citizens.
He waved his hand at the laptop. I understand, Lieutenant, I said. We're on it.
Okay, he said, fixing his ice blue eyes on me. Bring me up to date.
I summarized the footage of the first Windbreaker cop holdup in the Mercado, saying that the quality was worse than the footage of the one at the check cashing store. But still, we were able to see 3 men in SFPD jackets carrying guns. The job took about 5 minutes from A to Z, I said. They scored about $20,000. Sergeant Pichelny interviewed the store owner, who said the men in the SFPD Windbreakers locked them in the back room and then shot up the cash drawer. Hardly any words were spoken. No one was hurt.
Did they leave any evidence?
Nothing. They picked up the shell casings, they wore gloves. Conklin and I are going to look at the scene of last night's check cashing robbery where the owner was killed, and we're doing a follow-up interview with the survivor.
Okay. Come back with something, will you?
Brady was done.
I left him hunched over his computer and met Conklin in the all-day parking lot on Bryant. We were both impatient to interview Ben Vieira, the young man who'd been working at the check cashing store when his boss had been shot to death. Luckily, the kid had lived to talk about it. Chapter 17. Ben Vieira, the surviving witness to the robbery homicide at the check cashing store, cracked open his door about 4 inches, which was the length of the chain lock. He demanded to see our badges, and we held them up. He asked our names, and after we told him, he closed the door in our faces. I heard his voice on the telephone. He spoke and listened for a couple of minutes. The door opened again, this time wide enough to let us in. Vieira was of medium height and build, wearing green striped boxers and a Giants t-shirt. He was saying, "I called the police station to make sure you are who you say you are."
"Okay, I get that," Conklin said.
The one-room apartment on Poplar Street was dark and messy with pizza boxes and soda cans, dishes in the sink, and laundry on the floor. Vieira folded his futon bed into a sofa-like object, offered us seats, then got into a reclining chair and leaned back.
"I'm on Xanax. Prescribed for me. Just so you know."
"Okay," said Conklin.
"I already talked to the police the night of the thing," Vieira said to the ceiling.
"I know this is hard, Ben," said Conklin. "You've told the story, and now we want you to do it again. Some new thought could jump into your mind. Right now, we don't have a clue who those guys were. They're killers. You saw them, and we have to catch them."
Vieira sighed deeply before describing the holdup and the shooting, which had clearly traumatized him.
"Like I said, there were three of them. They were wearing police jackets and, like, latex masks. They came through the door fast. One aimed at us through the plexiglass teller window, and another one kicked open the security door. Then one of them told Mr. Diaz, 'Give us the money and no one will get hurt.'"
The young man went on to say that his boss had a gun, but never got off a shot. One of the masked robbers shot Diaz in the right arm. Another of them got Vieira in a chokehold, put a gun to his head, and demanded that he open the safe. Vieira told them the safe was in the floor and that he didn't know the combination.
"I swear on my mother."
Throughout the telling of this story, Vieira's flat affect hadn't changed. But there was a tremor in his voice, and I could feel the terror bubbling up just below the tranquilizer. He said,
"Mr. Diaz was rolling on the floor, screaming, but he wouldn't give up the combination. So then they shot him in the knee. Oh, God, it was bad. And then Mr. Diaz screamed out the combination. I opened the safe, and they took the money and left. I thought maybe Mr. Diaz was going to make it. He was always good to me. I don't even know why I'm alive."
Conklin and I took turns asking questions. "Did you notice anything unusual about any of the men? Did you recognize anyone's voice? Did any of the men seem familiar, like they'd been in the store before? Did any of them take off his gloves or mask? Did any of the men call anyone by name?"
"Maybe one of the guys called another of them Juan?"
It wasn't much, but we'd take it. I gave Vieira my card and told him to call me day or night if he remembered anything else. He said,
"I guess. God knows I can't sleep. And I can't forget."
He walked us to the door, and as soon as it was closed behind us, I heard the lock and the chain. Our next stop was the check cashing store with the sign over the window. Payday loans. Checks cashed. CSU was wrapping up, and CSI Jennifer Neuenhoff walked us through. She showed us where the robbers had kicked in the door between the public space and the back of the store. She showed us the massive bloodstain where Mr. Jose Diaz had bled out. We looked into the open safe in the floor. It was like looking into a grave. Neuenhoff said, "Not more than 30 million prints in here. They shouldn't take more than 3 lifetimes to process." Conklin said,
"Save yourself some time, Neuenhoff. The witness said the shooters wore gloves."
When we were back in the car, I called Brady and told him everything we had, which was pretty much a textbook case of how to stick up a store and make a clean getaway. I said we'd be back in the house in a couple of hours.
We've got a stop to make, First Lieutenant. Personal matter. After I hung up with Brady, I pulled the rubber band out of my hair, shook out my pony, and tried to shake off my sour mood at the same time. I pulled down the visor and slicked on some lip gloss, and even gave my eyelashes a thin coat of mascara. When my face was presentable, I said to my partner, "Okay, now you can step on it, Inspector."
"You want sirens, Sergeant?"
"Whatever you have to do." He snapped off a salute, which made me laugh, and not long after that, we parked outside the ferry building. Chapter 18. The San Francisco Ferry Building is not only the dock for ferries going to and from Alameda and Oakland, it's a spectacular marketplace. The Great Nave is more than 600 feet of arched arcade with a clock tower, and the entire building is a lively hub of restaurants, shops, offices, and a vibrant farmer's market. Conklin and I entered the building from the 30-foot-wide bayside wharf, skirted the tables of people grabbing quick lunches, and entered Book Passage, an expansive bookstore with floor-to-ceiling windows facing the San Francisco Bay. My partner and I made our way between the displays of new fiction and the long shelves of other books and reached the back corner of the store, where 9 or 10 people had taken seats facing a speaker at a lectern. The speaker was our own girl reporter, Cindy Thomas. She looked adorable, as always, wearing a soft blue cashmere sweater dress and rhinestone combs in her curly blonde hair. She was talking about her hot new book and skipped a beat when she saw us. Then she grinned and neatly recovered as we took seats. She said, "Fish's Girl is the true story of two killers who were bound together by love and serial murder. If that makes you think of Bonnie and Clyde, this pair was nothing like them, but just as crazy. Crazier, actually. And deadlier. Randy Fish and Mackenzie Morales killed separately, almost as if they were inside each other's minds." Cindy held up the book so her audience could see the grainy cover photo of her subjects walking hand in hand, the only known picture of Fish and Morales together. And then she told her small audience that as a crime reporter for the Chronicle, she had begun covering Randy Fish after he'd been convicted of killing 5 women in and around San Francisco.
"Fish had a preferred victim type," Cindy said. "His victims were slim, dark-haired college girls, and Mackenzie Morales was exactly the kind of woman Fish liked to torture and kill. But for some reason, Fish didn't kill Morales. In fact, he loved her, and spoke her name with his last breath. And she loved him, too."
Cindy went on to say that after Fish's death, she began to investigate Mackenzie Morales, who was the prime suspect in 3 murders, but that she had escaped police custody. While on the run, Morales was suspected in the murders of several women of the type Randy Fish had once targeted for torture and death. Cindy said,
"I had met Morales once, and I had inside information as to her possible whereabouts. I thought if I could create a safe place for her to talk, I could appeal to her ego. I hoped she would tell me why Randy Fish had become her mentor, her lover, and the father of her son. Sounds risky, right? Or maybe it sounds totally nuts for a reporter to chase a psychopathic killer in order to write a newspaper story. But I was hooked. And I thought the Fish-Morales story could be the crime saga of a lifetime. While researching the book, I came to understand that you don't always get the answers you're looking for, but the answers you get often tell it all. The whole story is in this book."
She'd done it. Whipped up her audience, who clapped enthusiastically, asked questions, and then lined up at the table so Cindy could sign their books. I couldn't stop beaming. I was so damned proud of her. I stood off to the side of the table, but I heard Conklin saying to Cindy,
"Sign this one to me. Don't spare the X's and O's. And sign this one to my mom."
Cindy laughed and said,
"You betcha. Whatever you like, handsome."
Cindy and Conklin had been having a hot, off-and-on relationship for years, and right now, they were on. I hoped that this time they were on for good. Cindy signed books for her man and maybe her future mother-in-law. When Conklin stepped aside, I asked the lady in line behind him if she could do a favor and take a photo.
You bet, she said.
I handed her my phone and grabbed my partner and my good friend. We put Cindy in the middle, linked arms around her, and said, "Cheese," and then we said it again. Cindy said,
"Let me see."
We all gathered around that little piece of tech that had caught all three of us, looking good. How often does that happen? A banner had been strung behind the podium. It was centered right over our heads. Author Cindy Thomas, today.
"Wow, this is totally great," Cindy said, doing a little dance in place. "A perfect photo of a perfect day."
Chapter 19. The man who called himself One was in the back seat of the four-door sedan, directly behind the driver. The two other guys in his crew were numbered 2 and 3, to prevent the accidental blurting out of an actual name. One knew that human stupidity was the only thing that could screw up this job. Everything else was easy. There were no security guards, no camera. There was plenty of cash in the drawer, and there was only one person in the store. Unlike bank jobs where security was tight and the average take was about 4 G's, check cashing stores ordinarily had 50 to 100,000 in the drawer. And while Mercado's had less, this one had an impressive stash on the premises from its Western Union franchise. One and his crew were quiet as they watched the light foot and car traffic on this commercial block of South Van Ness Avenue. When he was ready, One used a burner phone to call the cops. He said urgently,
911, the liquor store at 16th and Julian Avenue is being robbed. I just heard shots, lots of them. Send the cops right away.
He clicked off as the operator asked his name, but he knew she would put out the radio call. This diversion would draw any random cruisers patrolling the neighborhood and send them to a location a half mile away. Across the street, the girl in the brightly lit Spanish market was behind the counter, taking cash from a customer, an old man. One thought the girl looked to be in her mid-20s. She was wearing a long tan cardigan over a shapeless brown dress. When she'd put the groceries into the customer's striped fabric bag, she came from behind the counter and walked him to the front door, saying a few words to him in Spanish as they stood on the sidewalk. Then she went back inside the shop, closed the glass door, and flipped the sign inside the door to closed. One watched her walk to the back of the long, narrow store. When she was out of sight, Two said,
"She's alone, One. Did you want me to stay in the car, save some time?"
One heard sirens now, the cruisers and unmarks heading over toward 16th. It was time to go.
"Yeah, good idea. That'll work."
One and Three got out of the car with their SFPD windbreakers zipped up, masks in their pockets, and guns tucked down in their belts. It took only seconds to cross the street. When they stood in the deeply shadowed doorway of the little grocery store, they pulled on their masks. One adjusted the bill of his cap and knocked on the door, looking down so that the girl would see the SFPD on his windbreaker, but not his masked face. Three stood with his back to the store and looked at his feet while he waited for the locks to open. The locks clattered, and the bell above the door rang as the girl opened the door. The two men rushed the doorway. The girl screamed. One grabbed her arm and pushed her inside while showing her his gun. Three threw the locks and flipped the switches at the left of the doorway, dousing the lights in the entrance and front section of the store. The girl shouted, "Get out of here! Get out!" She wrenched her arm free, spun around, and broke for the back door. One shouted,
"Stop or I'll shoot. I mean it."
The girl stopped and cried out,
"Don't hurt me, please."
One said to her,
"No one wants to hurt you, miss. That's the truth. Now hands up. Turn around. That's it. Now go to the cash drawer and open it. Do that and everything will be fine. Just do exactly what I say."
The girl put her hands in the air and said,
"I'll give you the money. No problem."
She walked to the counter, edged behind it, and faced the gunmen with her back to the wall of cigarettes and mouthwash and deodorant. One spoke soothingly.
"That's good. Very smart. Now you can put your hands down and open the drawer. A minute from now, we'll be out of your life forever.
The girl hit a couple of keys. The cash register pinged, and the drawer shot open.
Way to go, said Three.
He leaned over the counter and reached for the money in the drawer. He wasn't ready for the gun the girl pulled out of the pocket of her baggy brown dress. Chapter 20. Maya Perez had two babies. One was growing inside her body, 14 weeks old now, and very precious to her. The other baby was this market. It had been her father's, and he had poured everything he owned and earned into keeping the shop open, to put food on their table, and because he wanted her to have something of value when he died. Then, a month ago, his cancer had killed him. Ricardo Perez hadn't lived to see his grandchild, but he had felt the baby was a blessing, and he had left Maya the deed to the store that had been named Mercado de Maya for her. And she loved this place. Every hand-lettered sign, the shelves her father and uncle had made from scrap lumber. She knew where every box, bottle, and tin belonged. Now that she was pregnant and on her own, the store meant survival. She had moved upstairs to her father's flat and intended to run this place and bring up her baby right here. There was no way she would let anyone steal from her. It was just not happening. Besides, there was something else. When the men in the police jackets came to the store, she thought they were looking for information on the check-cashing store holdup on Tuesday a few blocks away. But when she saw the masks and the guns, she knew that as soon as they got the money, they would shoot her, like they had done to Jose Diaz. Maya was having physical sensations she'd never had before. Tingling, lightheadedness, her blood pounding almost audibly. She knew that this was her body reacting to the fear of imminent death. There was no way to run or to hide, but she was thinking clearly, and she was determined. She thought, no way they're killing my baby. She kept her father's little Colt in her pocket. And when the man reached over the counter to get his hands on her money, she saw her chance. She had the gun pointing at his heart, her finger on the trigger, and she said very clearly and firmly, drop your gun. Maya barely saw the second man move. He was so fast. His hand came down hard on her arm. She got off a shot, but even in that split second, she knew her shot had gone into the floor. After that, the bullets punched into her, and everything went black. Chapter 21. It was after 8 p.m. when Conklin and I left the hall, both of us wiped out and done for the day. My partner walked me to my car in the Harriet Street lot. We were making comfortable small talk about whose turn it was to bring breakfast to our desks in the morning. I told him I'd see him then. I rolled up my window and had just fired up the engine when Brady called on my cell. I slapped my window, signaling to Richie to hang in. Brady sounded edgy. Boxer? A tipster has reported multiple gunshots coming from a Mercado de Maya on South Van Ness Avenue. He saw cops exiting the store in a hurry. Sounds like a possible windbreaker cop hit. Check it out. He gave me an address and I said, we're on the way.
Rich was still standing next to my car. On our way where? He said.
I headed my car towards South Van Ness with sirens and lights full on, while Rich called Joe and Cindy to say we'd been detoured. Within 5 minutes, I pulled up to the sidewalk 20 yards down the street from a small market with a sign over the window reading Mercado de Maya. A cruiser pulled up behind us. I got out of my vehicle and asked the two uniformed officers to drive around to the rear of the shop. Then, Conklin and I advanced on the front entrance to the little grocery store. This is always the worst moment. When you don't know if the scene is still hot, if bullets are going to fly, if victims are being used as shields. The front door of the market was wide open when my partner and I approached with guns drawn. The door jamb was intact, lights out in the store. Smell of gunfire. Hugging the doorway, I called out, "Police! No one move!"
I heard a moan and then a woman's voice saying, "Over here."
We entered the store. Conklin found the lights and covered me while I followed the voice to the floor behind the counter only yards away. I holstered my gun and knelt beside the victim. She was writhing in pain and bleeding from what looked to be several gunshot wounds.
"I've been shot," she told me. "He shot me."
The cash drawer was open. Bottles had fallen off the shelves. There had been a struggle. I heard Conklin speaking to dispatch, and backup was coming through the back door. I said to the victim, "Hang on. Paramedics are on the way. What's your name?"
"Maya Perez."
I said, "Maya, an ambulance will be here any minute. You're going to be okay. Do you know who shot you?"
"I'm pregnant,"
she said.
"You have to save my baby."
"Don't worry. The baby will be fine." I said it, but Maya Perez had lost a lot of blood. It was pooling on the floor, and she was still bleeding heavily from a gunshot wound to her thigh. I pulled my belt through the loops and cinched her thigh above the wound. It really didn't help. I asked her again, "Maya, do you know who did this to you?"
"A cop,"
she said.
"Two of them."
She coughed blood, and tears streamed down her face. She groaned and cupped her stomach through the blood-soaked fabric of her dress.
"Please, don't let my baby die."
Chapter 22. I gripped Maya Perez's hand and mumbled assurances I didn't quite believe. Where were the EMTs? Where were they? "This cop who shot you," I said. "Have you ever seen him before? Has he come into the store?" She whipped her head from side to side.
"They were wearing police jackets, masks, gloves, latex."
"Is there someone I can call for you? Maya, do you want me to call a friend? A relative?" Colored lights flashed through the front window as the ambulance parked on the sidewalk outside the market. Conklin shouted, "She's over here." I stood up to give the paramedics some room. "Her name is Maya Perez. She's pregnant," I said. The EMTs spoke to one another and to their patient, lifting her onto the stretcher and wheeling her out the door. I followed them. My heart was aching for Maya, imagining her fear for her unborn child. I stood for a moment and watched the receding taillights as the van took her toward Metropolitan Hospital. Then I called Brady. He asked,
"So, this was another cop heist?"
"Afraid so," I said. "Windbreakers, masks, gloves. She didn't know the shooter." As I talked to Brady, I was looking at all the likely places for a security camera to be positioned inside the store. I was hoping for an eye on the front door or the cash register. I found nothing, so, still talking with Brady, I went outside and looked for cameras on other shops that might be angled so that they caught the front of the Mercado. I said, "Brady, I don't see a security camera anywhere." He cursed, and we had a few more exchanges until I couldn't hear him over the sirens coming toward us from all points. Conklin and I closed the shop door and were waiting for CSU when I got another call from Brady.
"Maya Perez didn't make it," he told me.
"Damn it," I shouted. "Killed for the contents of her cash register. Does this make sense, Brady?"
"No. Come back to the house. I'll wait."
Chapter 23. It was close to midnight when Conklin and I got back to the hall. Brady was in his office, and although we'd been in constant contact for the last 4 hours, he wanted to talk to us. The fluorescent bulbs overhead cast a cold light over the night shift behind their desks in the bullpen, making them look as bloodless as zombies. Brady, too, looked half dead, and I would say that my partner and I didn't look any better. Conklin and I took the two chairs in Brady's cubicle. My partner tipped his chair back and put his shoes on the edge of the desk, which Brady hates, but this time he let it go.
"The MO was the same as the last two times," Conklin said. "The shooters left nothing behind except the rounds in Maya Perez's body. The ME is sending them to the lab." "We have to turn over every stone," said Brady, "and the dirt
under every stone.
I said, assuming these are the same windbreaker shooters, they're slick, Brady.
I went on to say that in the morning we'd go through the cop records again and look for motive. Cops who were ambitious but undistinguished, those who were disgruntled or had been suspended, or had retired early. I said to Brady, but even saying they're actually cops, they may not be from our station or even our city.
Brady nodded.
Then he said, I'm assigning additional people to this case. I had been focusing on the work ahead, so Brady's comment totally snapped my head around. I said, another team?
Inspectors Swanson and Vasquez are now on loan to me from robbery, along with four guys who are working for them.
Ted Swanson and Oswaldo Vasquez were reputed to be great cops. But assigning them and their teams to this case, rather than other detectives from homicide, only tangled the chain of command. I wasn't pleased.
Brady read my expression. He said,
here's what we've got. 3 big money heists, 2 DBs in 6 days, no evidence, media attention of the worst kind, and pressure from upstairs. So don't get territorial, Boxer. Swanson knows robbery homicide cold. Vasquez grew up on the streets. Whether the doers are cops or pretend cops, it doesn't matter. If we don't get those mopes into lockup, all of our jobs will be compromised. Understand?
I admire Brady. Sometimes I even like him. But he was ticking me off. Swanson and Vasquez had nothing on Conklin and me.
Get in touch with Swanson and Vasquez, he went on. I want all of you canvassing around that shop until you get somewhere or someone. This spree has got to stop, and I don't care who stops it.
We're on it, boss,
Conklin said.
Read you loud and clear, Lieutenant, I said through clenched teeth.
I felt a sleepless night coming on. Chapter 24. The square brick apartment house was at the dead end of a street lined with other plain 3-story buildings on Taylor Street at Eddy, the worst part of the Tenderloin. Yuki pushed in the outer door and pressed the intercom button marked Cordell. The buzzer blared, and Yuki climbed 3 stinking flights of graffiti-tagged stairs and knocked on the door at the end of the hallway. A woman cracked the door open.
I'm Yuki Castellano. Mr. Jordan from the Defense League sent me. Did you get a call?
Yes. Yes, please, come inside. Mrs. Cordell was African-American, very thin, about 40. She wore a red bandana over her hair and had yellow rubber gloves peeking out of the pockets of her cargo pants. Yuki walked behind her down a long, narrow hallway and entered a living room crowded with what looked to be generations of furniture. An elderly gentleman sat in a lounge chair, his hand on a carriage that he was rocking gently. Mrs. Cordell introduced Aaron Ray's grandfather as Neil Cordell and said her husband was at work.
My husband is a total wreck, she said. He doesn't sleep. He barely speaks. Aaron Ray's death has destroyed him.
Yuki took a seat on a worn brown sofa, and Mrs. Cordell sat in a matching armchair. On the table between them were pictures of a smiling Aaron Ray Cordell.
Why don't you tell me about your son?
Yuki said. The boy's mother picked up one of the photos and held it as she talked.
Aaron Ray was 15. He was so big he looked older than that, but he had the mind of a child.
Yuki nodded. Zack had told her that Aaron Ray was mentally handicapped, but had never been in any kind of trouble before his single, fatal incarceration.
He went to school every day, or so we thought, said Aaron's mother. I only found out later that he hung around bad places.
After the shooting at the crack house,
Yuki said. Mrs. Cordell nodded, and then her father-in-law told the story.
What happened is that Aaron Ray saw that these 3 dealers got shot, and he ran out onto the street. The cops came after him and arrested him for killing those men. It was a joke. Aaron Ray had the mind of a 5-year-old. He didn't even know how to shoot a gun.
Mr. Cordell seemed to realize that he was rocking the baby too hard, said into the carriage,
Sorry, sweetheart.
and clasped his hands in his lap. He was agitated and clearly grieving for his grandson. Yuki said to the elderly man,
"As I understand it, the police found the gun on Aaron Ray's person."
"Yes, that's true. He picked up the gun. He didn't think more than, 'Ooh, a gun.' And the police took him in, and they questioned him for hours, and didn't call us."
Mrs. Cordell picked up the story.
"If Aaron Ray hadn't been wrongly arrested, if the police hadn't played him by saying how great he was for killing those drug dealers, my son wouldn't have waived his rights, and he wouldn't have confessed, and he wouldn't have been killed in jail while waiting for trial. My son would still be alive."
Yuki felt the sharp pain of the people who had loved Aaron Ray, and she could see that now that she was with the Defense League, terrible stories like this one would be her life. Mrs. Cordell was saying,
"The police should pay for what they did, right, Miss Castellano? They should pay so that they don't do this to anyone else's child."
Yuki said,
"I agree. We've already filed the case against the city and the SFPD. It's going to be difficult, Mrs. Cordell. The city is going to defend itself. You may have to testify. Tough questions are going to be asked, and the city's lawyers are going to put Aaron Ray in a bad light if they can."
"We're all in," said Mrs. Cordell.
"So are we," said Yuki.
Actually, joining the Defense League seemed like a rash and very crazy idea. Was she even remotely cut out for this? Yuki embraced the Cordells and said goodbye. She hoped to hell she'd made the right decision. Because when Parisi and his expensive law firm hired by the city were through chewing her up, she might never want to practice law again. Chapter 25. After leaving the Cordells, Yuki drove 4 blocks and parked her car directly across the street from the crack house where 3 months before, Aaron Ray's life had taken a very bad turn at Turk and Dodge Place. As Aaron Ray's mother had said, the Tenderloin was a bad place to raise children. No kidding. It was the worst. The impoverished district was an underworld of savagery, mayhem, and despair, populated with aggressive drunks and crackheads, runaways, derelicts, streetwalkers, and violent thieves. The best you could say of people who survived on these streets was that they were pitiable. Most of them were doomed. Yuki knew better than to get out of the car. She was here to see the scene of Aaron Ray's death, to get the picture in her mind so that she could make a moving and watertight narrative for a jury. She stared ahead at the peeling, sagging wood frame building with a Chinese restaurant on the ground floor. The abandoned second floor, according to Yuki's information, was a flop house for junkies. The third floor was the trading floor, where wads of folding money and small packets of powder changed hands. She saw the scarred metal door that opened from the interior of the house and emptied out to the street. It was clear from the numbers of men and boys who looked both ways before going through that door that the crack house was doing a brisk business. Yuki imagined Aaron Ray Cordell hanging out at this place because it was cool, then being shocked and confused when the shooting went down. She saw him picking up the gun, a shiny, valuable object, and running. If this version of the story was true, and Zach Jordan believed it was, Aaron Ray had suffered wrongful death, and his family deserved justice that could only be delivered in the form of a multi-million-dollar settlement from the SFPD and the city. Yuki was thinking about the work yet to do when there was a rap on the window. Startled, she turned to see a uniformed officer making a circle with his index finger, indicating that she should roll down her window.
"Officer?
You having car trouble, miss?"
"No, not at all."
"You know it's not safe here, right? A woman got shot over on Hyde a couple of hours ago. Wait."
The patrolman leaned down to get a better look at her face.
"Aren't you the lady who's married to Lieutenant Brady?"
"Yes. I'm Yuki Castellano."
"I'm Clark. John. That's my office,"
he said, hooking a thumb toward his cruiser, smiling at her.
"You're working, Miss Castellano? Because I gotta say, I wouldn't like my wife to be in a car by herself on this block.
I'm okay, officer. I'm looking into a multiple homicide that took place a couple of months ago, she said, pointing to the crack house.
Oh, right. Those drug dealers who were whacked over there. I arrested that poor mutt who did it.
Aaron Ray Cordell?
Clark said. That's him. He was a runner. Ran out for coffee, smokes, that kind of thing. I don't know why he shot those pushers, but he did the city a service.
What did he say when you arrested him?
Yuki asked. Said he didn't do it, said Clark. I asked what it was he didn't do, and he said, I didn't shoot those guys upstairs. So we went into the house and found the DBs.
Yuki thanked the officer, then pulled her car out into the congested three-lane street. This would be a twisted story to sell to a jury, and maybe an impossible case to win. Chapter 26. Back in her new office at the Defense League, Yuki slugged down half a bottle of water, kicked off her shoes, and locked her handbag in a desk drawer. She booted up her computer and pulled up the Aaron Ray Cordell dossier Zach Jordan had compiled. The cops who interrogated Aaron Ray after his arrest were Inspectors Stan Whitney and William Brand in Narcotics Vice Division, SFPD. Yuki easily located the documents showing that Aaron Ray had been booked and incarcerated upstairs on the sixth floor of the hall, County Jail Number 3, pending trial. There was also a death certificate dated a day later, showing the teen's cause of death as sharp force trauma to the liver, and a brief report from the correctional officer on duty that a fracas had broken out in the showers. Eight suspects had been listed in the investigation of Aaron Ray's death, but there had been no evidence, no proof, no confession, and no informant had come forward. Aaron Ray's death had been subsequently written up as a killing by an undetermined individual, and no further action had been taken. The transcript of Whitney and Brand's interrogation of Aaron Ray Cordell wasn't listed in the document file, but Zach Jordan had already obtained the video. Yuki slipped discs into her computer. From the very beginning, the hairs on her arms stood up as she watched the masterful interrogation of a mentally challenged black kid by a team of experienced investigators. She watched for about an hour. Then she called her new assistant, Gina, and told her that she needed to have a deposition notice served on SFPD inspectors Stan Whitney and William Brand. Chapter 27. Conklin and I had met up with robbery divisions Edward, Ted Swanson, and Oswaldo Vasquez on the corner of Mission and 23rd Street, down the block from the now-shuttered Mercado de Maya. Swanson and Vasquez got out of their unmarked Chevy and we all shook hands. Swanson was stocky, with a pleasant face, sandy hair, and light gray eyes. He was exactly my height at 5'10", probably my age, too. Vasquez was muscular, shorter and younger than his partner, with an impressive grip. Looked like he'd once been a prize fighter. The four of us, along with another team from robbery, worked the streets adjacent to the Mercado, canvassing dives and whorehouses and apartments in the area. I personally went through Maya's apartment above the Mercado, looking for anything that would indicate that her death was anything but a murder of convenience for the Windbreaker cops. I found nothing but a small, neat home and a tiny room Maya had prepared for her unborn child. This was as heartbreaking a vignette as you could possibly imagine. The walls were a sunny yellow in a room that never got sunshine. The crib had been made by hand, as had the mobile of rainbows hanging over it. It was all too touching, too sweet, and if I never see a rainbow mobile again, it will be too soon. I interviewed Perez's neighbors, who told me what a sweetheart Maya was, and a few of them cried. Feeling heartsick and angry, I rejoined the canvas, and between the eight of us, we came up with exactly no idea who had robbed the market and shot Maya Perez to death. No one admitted to even seeing the robbery go down, and this time there was no grainy surveillance footage. When our shifts were over, the eight of us refueled at a local diner and went back to canvassing both sides of the block again, catching up with people who had day jobs and had just returned home. We still got nothing.
And then I got a call from Clapper, head of forensics.
We've run the slugs taken from Maya Perez.
Good. What did you get?
238s. The gun that fired them isn't in the system. I wish I could give you something. A name, another shooting, something.
There are days when being a cop is challenging and worthwhile, and days where the job is duller than watching a dripping faucet. Today was neither. A cold canvas in the mission was stressful and dangerous, and it had been unproductive. A total bust. Conklin and I went back to the hall and briefed Jacoby and Brady on our great, huge bag of nothing. That meeting took about 5 minutes, including the Q&A. I walked with Richie out to the parking lot. He tried to cheer me up, saying,
"Someone is going to slip up. Bad guys almost always do."
I've said the same thing to Richie. Joe has said the same thing to me. It's the cop's version of everything is going to be okay. Ha. Whoever these windbreaker bastards were, they were organized, they were disciplined, they had untraceable weapons, and their timetable was short. How long would it be before another low-tech, high-cash business was shot all to hell by men portraying themselves as San Francisco's finest? My partner and I waved goodbye, got into our respective cars, and exited the lot. As I made the turn up Bryant, I glanced up at the hall and saw that Jacoby's office light was still on. I felt bad for him. The job was my former partner's entire life. We had to get these shooters for a number of reasons, and one of them was surely that we had to do it for Jacoby before he retired as chief of detectives. Chapter 28. Life was good, Shea Molinari. Martha, our loyal doggie, was asleep on the sofa next to my dear husband, and although he was on the phone, the wonderful aromas coming from the kitchen told me dinner was ready.
"Hey, Blondie,"
said my husband, cupping the phone. I blew him a kiss and went to the baby's room. Julie was sleeping on her back. She had kicked off her blanket, so I pulled it up to just under her arms. She waved a fist in her sleep, and I kissed her sweet forehead. She pushed me away. I took this as a sign that my little girl was asserting her personality, even in her sleep. Go, Julie. But seeing my beautiful child brought me straight back to Maya Perez's apartment. I visualized the small, windowless room she had turned into a chick yellow nest for her baby, who would never be. I watched Julie breathing for more than a few minutes. Then I shucked my clothes and hit the rain box for 15 delicious minutes. When I returned to the living room in my man-in-the-moon patterned PJs, Joe was dishing up the chicken cacciatore. I went over to him and got a big hug, a kiss, and a belated jumpity how-to-do from Martha. I said, "Lucky, lucky me." And I meant it. "Vino?" Joe asked me. "You don't have to twist my arm," I said. "So, what did the home team do today?"
"I've been doing a little work," he told me.
"Really?"
"Free work. I've been looking into the CBM case."
Joe seemed to be in a very perky mood. He pulled out a bar stool for me and another for himself, and we sat down at the kitchen island to eat. "What, I have to ask, is CBM? He poured out the glasses of wine and explained,
"Claire's birthday murders."
"Really?" I said, repeating myself. "And you came up with something?"
"I think so," he said. "The start of something, anyway."
I liked what I was hearing, but at the same time I felt a little bad. Here was this big-time law enforcement guy on the bench, now doing unpaid busy work, for me. But he wasn't complaining. "Tell me about it," I said.
"I'm gonna do that. Eat your dinner before it gets cold."
I tucked in. Joe leaned closer and said,
"I went back 5 years and found every crime that happened on the 12th of May in San Francisco. A lot of shit happened, Lenz."
"I'm guessing 56 murders a year," I said.
68 last year," he said.
We grinned at each other. I loved working with Joe. I was even a little envious that my husband had the time to focus on this case and work it from home.
Although there was no shortage of violent crime, very little of it resembled the murder of your victim on Balmy Alley. Along with the three fatal stabbings from this year and the previous two, I found a stabbing fatality in each of the two previous years that met my narrowly defined parameters. And I didn't find any stabbing fatalities just like it on any other days or in the years preceding the one that happened 5 years back.
Tell me about the stabbings in years one and two.
Joe grinned.
You don't have to beg.
He took our empty plates to the sink and brought two slices of pie to the island. It was apple pie, and he'd stopped to put ice cream on top. I looked at him like, is this for real?
Nope, I didn't make the pie. But then I was busy on a very twisted and highly interesting case.
I laughed at him, grabbed a plate, and stuck in a fork.
Run it for me, will ya?
Yes, I will, Sergeant, said Joe.
Chapter 29.
So I did a little time traveling, Joe said. The victim in year one of the five was an uptown lady, Ms. Alicia Thompson. She had been to Neiman's and she was on her way to her car.
We know this how? I asked.
Shopping bag and keys in a hand. And she was killed a half block from Union Square Garage, where her car was parked.
Did anyone see anything?
Nope, and Ms. Thompson got the full five-star investigation. She was the lead investigator.
And how did the case play out?
Not only were there no witnesses, there were also no forensics, no footage, no nothing. Not even the knife. Make a note, Sergeant Blondie. Taking the knife is a common thread.
Duly noted, I said.
Okay. Next victim was very different than Ms. Thompson.
Do tell, I said. I took the empty dessert plates away and put them in the dishwasher while Martha and Joe headed to the living room. We all settled into the oversized leather sofa. Martha put her head on my lap, letting out a contented sigh.
Victim number two, Krista Toomey, was homeless, Joe said. 25 years old, in bad shape even for a meth addict. She was sleeping in an alley in the Tenderloin, Olive Street. No witnesses, but plenty of people knew her.
And were they able to contribute anything?
Nothing useful. I found the autopsy report. Like your victim who was stabbed in the back outside her father's diner, this girl was also stabbed from behind. The first or second blows were fatal, but the killer kept going. Stabbed her all over her back, arms, buttocks, 35 separate wounds. Based on the shape and depth of the wounds, the weapon was probably a paring knife, but it wasn't found. Again, no witnesses, no evidence, and because there were no leads and no friends or relatives stepping forward putting pressure on the police, and there were a whole lot of open cases at that time, this one went cold.
I understood. I might even have been aware of this crime. All murder cases should be worked and solved. But there's not enough manpower, not enough time, and some cases just don't get solved. I said, whoever killed these women is smart, aware of cameras and bystanders and what constitutes forensic evidence. The victims were all women, and it looks like the five you've identified were all killed by a common type of knife that is never left behind.
Agreed, Linz. Add all that to the date they were all killed, May 12th. And that's why I suspect one person killed the five of them.
So you conclude what about the killer?
If my theory is right, this dude didn't know his victims, said Joe. He chose these women because the circumstances were favorable to him. And whatever his motive for murder, he was driven to kill violently. This is a guess, but I'd say he was mad as hell. He kills people he doesn't know in a ferocious rage.
Yeah, I can see that. And since he kills in daylight and no one sees him, he's got a cloak of invisibility.
I decided to leave something for you to figure out.
Aw, thanks. My husband patted my thigh.
I believe my work here is done.
Let's go to bed.